Good morning, Jamestown. My name, as Ben said, my name is Jeremy, and I'm super excited to be with you this morning. As you sit down, if kids want to be dismissed, they can take off. You're welcome. We got it. I'm excited to be here this morning. It's always fun to be here, but it's even more fun for me to be here on the day that we get to launch into our Christmas series. I'm one of those people that loves this season. Like, Christmas, of all of them, Christmas is my jam. Like, anybody else, like, Christmas is kind of your favorite? Like, I'm the crazy person who every year, I kind of make sure that we have our Christmas tree up before Halloween. Anybody else? Like, when we got married, we were like Scrooges, and we'd put it up sometime in November. But over the years, we started moving it earlier. And now, like, for our family, like, Halloween is the day. Like, if it's not up yet, like, it's got to go up. I shared that once, and I had somebody send me an email. Like, if it helps you put it up even easier, there's always this option. Right? Like the ghost tree, and then, you know, Halloween comes, and then boom, Christmas. I love Christmas. I love the decorations. I love the time. I love the candy, like those little chocolate Cadbury eggs with like the little candy shell. Love them. Christmas is my favorite. I try to draw it out for as long as I can because I love the season. And I also recognize that Christmas, I think especially, but kind of all the holidays, but it feels like especially Christmas. This is one of those holidays that often we have a number of different kind of perspectives or a number of different things that we carry into it. That for some of us, you're right there with me. Like, your tree is up. You can't wait. You love this time of the year. For some of you, maybe this is a season, you're kind of coming into Christmas, like, if you could, you just want to, like, press pause on this moment in your family's life, because you look at it, and maybe it's because you've got young kids, and you realize, you know deep down inside that, like, your kids aren't going to stay young forever, and right now, your family's in a space where kind of your countertops, your table, it's all full of all those little, like, toy ads you get this time of the year, right? And those toy ads are everywhere, and they're circles, and they're scribbles, and it kind of drives you nuts because it's clutter all over the place. But you know a day isn't far off when your kids are just going to kind of, like, throw those away because they just don't care anymore. And you just wish right now you could just press pause and just kind of stay in this moment. I find for my family, we're kind of in that space a little bit this year, because as we were kind of stepping into this Christmas season, I should have realized this earlier, but one of my oldest kid is a junior in high school, which means we get this Christmas and then next Christmas, and then she's living wherever that's, like, then I'm looking forward to her coming home from wherever college might look like. And all of a sudden I realize, like, I only kind of have two left where she's, like, living in my home for the entire season. And everything in me just wants to, like, press pause. And I know mine's a junior. Some of you have seniors, and you already know where next year is going to be and where you'll be looking forward to them coming home from. And you're kind of right there with me. You wish you could just press pause. For some of you, this is kind of this brand new season where you've got new kids in the home, and now you're buying presents for children that you were just praying for last year, and you get to experience kind of all the glitz and glamour of Christmas through the eyes of a child, and you're looking forward to it. For some of you, you don't wish you could press pause. For some of you, this is a season that you wish you could just speed right through. Because this for you isn't one of the first with. For you, it's a first without. And you've known for a while that, like, this is coming. And even the idea of a series leading up to Christmas reminds you of how maybe lonely or alone this season feels like. Because it's the first one that you're celebrating without. And quite honestly, it's all of that. If we kind of take all of those things, it's one of the reasons why I so appreciate the Christmas story. Because the Christmas story, if we actually dive into it and we actually see the story for what it is, one of the things we find is that the story kind of holds all of that. It holds the hope and the despair and the loss and the wondering of like, how are we going to make it through? Like, if we actually dive into the story, what we find is that it holds all of those stories, all of our stories. And so we're going to be doing that this morning. If you want to follow along, we are going to be in Ruth chapter 1 this morning. And like Ben said, y'all had like a snow day last week. Which means today, we've got some ground we need to cover this morning. I'm grateful, Jesus, when he was asked, like, what's the greatest commandment? Like, if you could take the whole Bible and sum it up, what would it be? Jesus, he quoted something much earlier from Deuteronomy, the Shema. He said, the thing is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And I do believe that we can worship God. We do worship God with all of those things. There are moments we worship God with our hearts, right? You feel something. Maybe it's a song, something happens, and you feel something that turns you to God. That sometimes we worship God with our souls, that you hear something that's just true or something happens, and like you feel it deep down inside of you that like this just has to be true, that there are times we worship God with our souls. That there are times we worship God with our strength. Maybe for you, you're an athlete and you realize that like, you know that the talents that you have are not your own, but God has given them to you. And so you turn them back kind of through gratitude and trying to do what you can do to point people back to him. And there are times we can worship God with our minds. And so this morning, is it okay if we do that this morning? Well, I promise I'm going to try to do it as kind of engaging as we can. We've got pictures. I've got maps. I brought a laser. It's going to be awesome. Ruth chapter 1. But I actually want to start not by turning to Ruth, but by asking why in a Christmas season we're not reading Matthew or Mark or Luke. We're not reading a story. We're not focusing on a story about the birth of Jesus, one of the gospel writers, right? The people that write the accounts of Jesus. Why Ruth? And the answer to that is I do think one of the authors of one of our gospels, gospel just means good news. It's kind of an account of the life of Jesus. One of the gospel writers, I think the way he starts telling the story of Jesus actually says, I think he agrees that in order to understand the story of Jesus, one of the people we need to understand is the person of Ruth. It's the author Matthew in Matthew's account. Let me show you how Matthew starts telling the story of Jesus. Matthew starts with a long list of names, a genealogy. I know for some of you, like you've got this memorized. This is like your favorite passage. I'm going to read it for those of us that haven't. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of... I always feel bad for that guy, right? Like, there's all these really cool names. There's Amminadab, there's Nashon, there's Ram. And then the dude that's, like, named after a fish, right? Like, Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And now, this is the chunk in our Bible that we just skim over, right? Let's be honest. But Matthew starts this way for a reason. And one of the things Matthew does is he includes some names that for us, we just blow right over. But in Matthew's original audience, they would have leapt off the page because they would have recognized Matthew is doing something different. In Matthew's world, if you're going to write a genealogy, Matthew in this, he's doing a number of things. He wants to connect Jesus to Abraham and then later to David. But one of the things you do if you're Matthew, if you're an author in his world, is when you write a genealogy, you only include the list of prominent men. That's how his world worked. Matthew does something different. That if we were reading this in Matthew's original audience, there's a handful of names that would have jumped out. If we go to that next, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth. If we kept reading, Matthew's going to include one more woman in the genealogy. That in Matthew's world, this is not what you did. It's not how you tell the story. These names would have jumped out off the page, which makes you ask the question, why does Matthew do it? Why does he include these people? Well, homework, if you want. Do some looking into the stories of the names that Matthew includes in the genealogy and ask why, if Matthew's telling the story of Jesus and he's going to insert these four names, why and what is he doing? And one of the things we want to do is we want to ask that question of that last name up here, the person of Ruth. Why does Matthew say, in order to understand Jesus, you also need to understand the story of Ruth? So we're going to explore that together over the next handful of weeks. And we're going to start by looking right at Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. How does the book of Ruth start? Let's throw it on the screen. Ruth chapter 1. Verse 1. Oh yeah, if we go to that last one. Ruth, it says, is the essentially great-grandma of King David. We know Jesus is going to come out of the family line of David, which means Ruth is Jesus' great-great-great-great times 28, I counted them, grandma. Okay, we good on that? So Ruth is in Jesus' family tree. Ruth is great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandma. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled. Now we already need to press pause on the book of Ruth because the book is going to use some language that is a little bit different for us. The word judge, we use the word judge today. When you think of a judge, how many of you think of like this guy, right? It's a gavel in hand. It's somebody who sits in a courtroom, hears these cases from both sides, gives this ruling. This is what we think of when we think of a judge. In the book of Ruth, this couldn't be further from what the book is saying. When we talk about how Ruth happens during the time when the judges ruled, this is not the type of judge it's talking about. So what is it talking about? Well, in the time when the judges ruled is essentially placing Ruth during a kind of a time in Israel's history. They'd just come out of Egypt. They'd wandered the promised land. They'd wandered the desert. And now they just enter the promised land. And we're in a section of Israel's history where they don't yet have a king. If you were to ask them, they would say that they do have a king. God is their king. They do not have an earthly king, but there are times that somebody would have to rise up. Somebody would have to rise up to lead the people. Those leaders they called the judges. So they were not courtroom people with a gavel. They were the leaders who stood up and led the people in the place of a king. And during the book of Judges, we kind of find this cycle play out. Seven times in the book of Judges, we read this cycle. If we look at a circle, let's pretend we start at the very top of the circle. The cycle starts where things are going well in Israel. There's food in the fields. Things are going well. Everything's going well in Israel. Everything's going so well, in fact, that the people forget about God. They don't mean to. They don't necessarily make a decision one day to like, we're going to turn our backs on God and we're going to rebel and we're going to, they don't wake up one day and do it, but slowly, because things are going so well for them, they just slowly forget about God. They're no longer giving thanks for the gifts that God has given. They start believing that like we have what we have because it's the work of our hands, because we have achieved all of this. And they forget about God, and then they start to kind of turn their backs on God. Then because they forget about God, because they've turned their backs on God, what happens is what was going well now goes poorly. That often the book of Judges, when things go bad for the people, sometimes it's a foreign nation comes in and like there's war and they're oppressing the people. Sometimes it's that your fields that were filled with abundance are now barren and they're empty. Things are going badly for the people. Then what happens is when things are going badly for the people, somebody rises up. This is usually when one of the judges in the book of Judges kind of stands up and says, oh, you know why this is happening? Because we've forgotten to follow the ways of God. And so that person is going to turn everybody back. They're going to turn their eyes back towards God. They're going to start following again the ways of God. And then when they do that, things again go well for them. And things go so well, in fact, that over time they slowly start turning. They slowly start forgetting about God. And then does this make sense? This cycle, rinse and repeat in the book of Judges about 7 times. Things go well, they forget about God, they turn away from God. Things go poorly, foreign nation comes in, famine hits the land. They then turn their eyes back towards God. Things then go well, 7 times. So the book of Ruth starts by letting us know that even though chronologically, if you start reading your book from your Bible from the beginning, you have kind of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Then you have the people entering the promised land and Joshua, Judges. Ruth comes next, but it wants to let you know that the story of Ruth happens during the time of the judges. So during the time the judges ruled, next verse, or kind of the end of that verse. This is kind of a thesis statement during the time of the judges. In those days, Israel had no king and everyone did as they saw fit. Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. Ruth verse 1. It says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. We might read these two things as just kind of two statements giving us some context to the book. But Ruth's original audience would have heard these things connected. Because remember, the time the judges ruled, we have this cycle. There's a famine in the land. As a reader that knows the background, where are we right now in that cycle? We're kind of in that bottom right? Things are going badly for the people. And then if you think of that cycle, what is supposed to happen next is somebody supposed to stand up and say, oh, things are going badly. There's famine in the land because we've turned away from the ways of God. If we turn back, things can go better for us again. Let's check out what happens next in the book of Ruth. It says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and 2 sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites. Ephrathite just means that you're from Bethlehem. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Do they rise up and say, oh, there's a famine because we need to turn our eyes back to God? You know, in a lot of ways, they say, oh, there's a famine. Let's now move to a foreign nation. And there's movement in the story. Anytime there's movement in the story, I would argue that we should almost read with like our Bibles in one hand and our maps in the other. So in the story, where are we leaving from? Where was hometown? Bethlehem. Where you've heard of Bethlehem, right? So this story starts in Bethlehem. They are going to leave Bethlehem and they're going to head to Moab, which means we should look at a map. So if we go to our next screen, this is where Bethlehem is located on kind of a satellite image of Israel. So Bethlehem is kind of just left of the top of the Dead Sea. If you're this family, you're Elimelech, you're Naomi, you're these sons, there's famine in Bethlehem. There's no food, right? There's no food in Bethlehem, which actually is a little bit ironic already. Because the actual word Bethlehem is a combination of 2 Hebrew words. Let's throw the Hebrew word for Bethlehem. The word Bethlehem is a combination of Beit and Lechem. Beit, Lechem, Bethlehem, Bethlehem. If we translate these 2 words, Beit, Lechem, Bethlehem means house of bread. Beit means house, Lechem means bread. Bethlehem is the house of bread. And in the story, the irony of the story is what's wrong with Bethlehem? What are they lacking in Bethlehem? There's no bread, right? There's nothing in the fields. Our land is barren. The house of bread lies empty. There's no bread. So if we go back to the map, we're in Bethlehem. If you're this family, and you're trying to figure out, based on the map, where you go, where there might be more fertile land, there's a number of options you might look at. Laser. Oh, that's the lighter. This is my laser. That would have been interesting. Okay, so if you're in Bethlehem, do you notice the area on the map that's a little bit more green? Which direction would you go? west, right? Problem during the book of Judges, the Philistines live to the west. The Philistines are the sea people. They live on the coastal plains right off the Mediterranean. During the book of Judges, anybody remember the story of Samson? Samson is constantly engaged in this battle with the Philistines. Samson's story was during the book of the Judges. There's a story right kind of after the Judges, kind of right after this time period, where there's a young boy who defeats this giant Philistine. David and Goliath happens right after this time. So during Elimelech and Naomi, during this time, you can't move west, although it's greener, because the Philistines live there. There's some other green, if you look kind of up here. Problem, during the book of Judges, what we find in the north is the tribes up here are almost constantly at war. So you have Philistines to the west, you have war to the north. If you head to the south, you see what color this all is? That is the Negev Desert. This is uninhabitable really today in the ancient world. Zero chance you live in the south. You cannot live in the south. I once rented a rental car and drove through all of this. There is nothing there to this day. During this day, you just can't. So there's one option where you can move, right? You're going to move east to the area of Moab. It's really your kind of one option. We'll go ahead and so the next slide, I was actually going to teach you a little bit about rainfall and why there's a pretty practical reason you might also go to Moab. We're going to skip that because we still want to eat lunch today. If you want to geek out with me afterwards and like I'll put my Blake Harms hat on and tell you about rainfall and why Moab might be a good option, I'll be here after the service. But let's jump to the next slide. Okay, so if you're in Bethlehem today, this is what the city of Bethlehem looks like. Today it's a large city. During Jesus' day, it was actually quite small. It would have been probably something up here. During the time of Jesus, Bethlehem was a small village. It became a big city because over the years, people want to live where Jesus was born. It's what happens. So if you're in Bethlehem today, actually one of my favorite places in Bethlehem today, I pointed out every time we go to Bethlehem, that next photo, the Stars and Bucks Cafe. Apparently Bethlehem is like the one place in the world you can blatantly rip off the largest coffee chain in the world and somehow get away with it. They sell cool mugs. So if we go back to Bethlehem, so during Jesus' day, Bethlehem is probably somewhere right up here. The Church of the Nativity, which kind of commemorates Jesus' birth, is right in that area. Do you notice here that kind of hazy area right up here? Can you kind of see that? Yeah, if we jump into these hills, you get a better view. Those cliffs, that is all Moab. So from Bethlehem, when you look out to the east, you can see Moab. It's relatively close. It's about a two-day journey from Bethlehem to Moab. And so in our story, Elimelech and Naomi and their kids, there's famine in Bethlehem. Beit Lechem has no bread. There is nothing in the land. They decide, let's move there because things might be better for us. And then what we find is things for them go from bad to worse. In the next verse, we read this. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, dies. And she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and without her husband. In verse 3 and 4, all of the men in this family now die. It's actually, names are interesting in this. The boys, the one Mahlon, that name means sickly. And then Chilion, the other name, it means frail. So you just meet them. You meet sickly and you meet frail. And it's almost like the author saying like, hey, don't get connected, right? Like the next verse, they're both gone. And now the book of Ruth begins with a people in a foreign land, There are no more. And Naomi's husband has died. Her sons have died. And none of her sons have had children. So we have three women. We have Naomi, we have Orpah, and we have Ruth. And in their world, this would have been devastating. It'd be devastating in anybody's life, but especially in their world. Because in their world, there's kind of like an order of how provision and protection would happen. Let me show you the order. So if you were a female in Ruth's world, a provision who would provide for you and who would protect you would start with dad. So as long as dad was alive and you were not yet married, dad would provide for you. You would live in dad's house. Dad would provide. Women in their world could not get jobs. You could not own land. You could not provide for yourself. Dad would do that. Dad would do that until you got married, and then your provision, your protection would then transfer to your husband. If your husband then died, well, dad is still around. It goes back to dad. Does this make sense? If dad is gone and your husband is gone, then your provision, your protection would come from your sons. In our story, Naomi's husband is dead. Ruth and Orpah's husbands are dead, and they have no kids. The story starts kind of feeling like, can you feel kind of the desperation? These three women wondering, how in the world are we going to get through this? What are we going to do? What will happen is Naomi will get this idea of like, okay, what if we head back home? We read it in the next verse. It says, when Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people, providing food for them, this is back home, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Next one. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. Tells us dads are probably gone. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. There's an interesting move that happens here. Naomi starts heading back home with her daughters-in-law, right? Orpah and Ruth. But somewhere along the way, Naomi says, hey, how about you women, you go kind of find the rest of your life somewhere else. You don't come with me. You kind of go off on your own. I always wondered why. It's interesting, isn't it? That instead of keeping this family together, the wives of her sons, she's trying to send them off. Why? Well, I wonder if Naomi doesn't know something about who these women are and what might happen if she shows up back at home in her homeland with these two women. Because there's something in the story that, again, to them would have leapt off the page that to us, I think we often jump over. It's who these women are. Orpah and Ruth, if we go to it, says they're not just women, but they married who? Moabite women. To us, this is just a detail we skip right over. But in their world, this would have been huge. Because the Israelite people had an opinion of the Moabites. They had laws around how you are to treat the Moabites. The Moabites weren't just another people who lived on those hills across the Dead Sea. The Moabites, before this moment, there are only kind of a couple stories that highlight the Moabites. One of them, I want to teach you the story. I'll kind of paraphrase it. We won't go there significantly. We'll read a couple pieces. But it's a story between these two people, Balaam and Balak. Now, Balak is the king of Moab. The whole story, if you want to read it, is in Numbers 22 to 25. But what's happening in the story is essentially the Israelite people, they've wandered the desert. They are now moving into the region of Moab. And Balak, the king of Moab, sees the size of the Israelite people and he freaks out a little bit. They're way bigger than his people. If they attack, there's no way we could defend ourselves. In Numbers 22, it starts this way. It says, then the Israelites traveled to the plains of Moab and camped along the Jordan across from Jericho. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was terrified because there were so many people. Indeed, Moab was filled with dread because of the Israelites. If we quick go to the map, so it says they were camped across the Jordan from Jericho, which means the Israelite people are right kind of in this region right here, which is just on the doorstep of Moab. And so Balak, the king of Moab, says, okay, we've got to do something about this. What he thought is, okay, we could try to fight, but we'll lose. Well, we could just try to let them in, but they will completely overwhelm us. And so what Balak decides to do is reach out to this guy by the name of Balaam, who we learn is kind of like, essentially is kind of this like witch doctor from Pethor, which feels like an obvious like third option, right? And so Balak reaches out to kind of this witch doctor. We read it here. It says, so Balak, son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to summon Balaam, son of Beor, who is at Pethor near the Euphrates River in his native land. Balak said, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the land and have settled next to me. Now come and put a curse on these people because they are too powerful for me. Perhaps then I'll be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that whoever you bless is blessed and whoever you curse is cursed. Balak sends word. Balaam comes to Moab. Now what happens is Balak will bring Moab, so will bring Balaam to a place where he can see the Israelite people. And Balak says, okay, now pronounce a curse on them. And if you curse them, then maybe we can defeat them. So Balaam stands up and he tries to pronounce this curse, but when he opens his mouth, God gives him the words of a blessing instead of a curse. So he does not curse the people, he blesses them. Balak is standing right there. How does Balak like what just happened? Balak freaks out, right? This isn't what I hired you for. You're supposed to curse them and you stand and bless them? So Balaam says, okay, well, maybe it's because I don't have a great view of the people. Maybe bring me to a spot where I can see them better. And so Balak does. And then Balak tells Balaam, like, okay, now curse the people. And so Balaam opens his mouth and again, does not curse the people, he blesses them. Balak is losing his mind. What are you doing? Balaam says, okay, I don't know what's happening. This has never happened before. Like, maybe if you bring me to a spot where I can see all of the Israelites, maybe that'll fix it. So Balak brings Balaam to a spot where he can see all the Israelites. Balaam opens his mouth and again gives a longer blessing over the people. Doesn't just bless them, but he also says that God will curse whoever tries to curse the Israelite people. How does Balak like that? Freaks out, loses his mind, sends Balaam home. The story ends really awkward. Like Balak's mad, Balak's mad, everything's going on. Balak then has to decide, what am I going to do now? Balaam will not curse the people. He can't curse the people. So Balak comes up with this idea. Well, what if we can convince the Israelite people to turn away from their God and essentially bring a curse on themselves? So Balak's answer, to summarize it in for time, is essentially he brings out women and booze. Honestly, he brings in some women from the Moabites, and what we read is this. Well, Israel is saying, and there are some places that are like awkward to say on a stage because they're hard to say, and then there are words like that. Well, Israel was saying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women who invited them to sacrifices to their gods. The people ate the sacrificial meal, bowed down before these gods. So Israel yoked themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against them. That the Israelite people essentially turn their backs on God. And the story ends with like, Balak is mad because Balaam wouldn't curse them. God is mad. Moses is mad. Everybody's mad. If you know the story, like Balaam has a talking donkey that is also mad. Like it's a weird story. But so everybody's mad. But notice why the Israelites end up bringing a curse on themselves is because these Moabite women enter the camp and seduce them away from their own God. Moses shortly later, the book of Deuteronomy is kind of Moses' speech, a sermon to the people. in it, Moses will include a rule, a law, a command concerning how the Israelites are to treat the Moabites going forward. It's in Deuteronomy 23. It says this. It says, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation," which is their way of saying ever. "For they did not come to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt. And they hired Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor in Aram Naharaim to pronounce a curse on you. However, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but turn the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live." In our Bible, Moses gives the people the command, never, never let the Moabites in. You may never treat them as friends. You may never welcome them into your community because remember what they did to our people back then. Never may they be allowed back in. And now I wonder if you have Naomi heading back home, heading back to Bethlehem, and if somewhere along the journey she realizes, oh, I'm bringing two Moabite women. And my hope is maybe I can find provision. Maybe I can find a better life back home. But if I come bringing these two, I don't know how they'll receive me. I don't know how they'll treat them. I don't know how they'll treat me. Because it's possible they show up in Bethlehem. And the people of Bethlehem say, we cannot let them in because the Bible says so. Because Moses gave a command. So the story of Ruth, the story we're looking at for Christmas. It starts in the wrong time, right? It's the time of the judges. Things are wrong. The circumstances are wrong. There's a famine in the land. We have the wrong person, a Moabite woman by the name of Ruth, walking into Bethlehem, wondering, how are they going to treat me? How are they going to receive me? God, what are you going to do next? How are you going to move this story forward? Does that story sound like anything else? Like a story starting in the wrong kind of time, with the wrong circumstances, with the wrong person, in this girl, this young girl heading to Bethlehem, wondering, how are they going to receive me? How are they going to welcome me in? What is going to happen? About 1,100 years later, during a time when things are going wrong, when Rome is in control of the land, when there is a paranoid ruler, a king, King Herod, sitting on the throne, we have a wrong person, a young, unmarried, pregnant, likely teenage girl heading to Bethlehem. Like Ruth, not because it's her hometown, but because it's her fiance's hometown, wondering, how in the world are they going to receive? Will they receive me? Will they reject me? How is this going to work? And God, how are you going to move this story forward? See, I wonder if Matthew starts telling the story of Jesus by pointing back at the story of Ruth. Because in so many ways, the story of Ruth is our Christmas story. The wrong person at the wrong time showing up in Bethlehem. And this time, we know the story. Mary is going to show up in Bethlehem. Remember, what does Bethlehem mean? The house of bread. Ruth takes place when Bethlehem has no bread. Mary is going to show back up to the house of bread, is going to have a son who later is going to use bread to identify himself, right? Jesus will say, I am the very bread of life, that whoever is hungry, whoever is in need, that whoever, for whomever the world feels hopeless and their story feels like despair, if you come to me, Jesus saying, I will do something new even in the midst of the darkest of circumstances. See, I think the Christmas story, one of the reasons I so love this season is because I think we need this story. that the Christmas story doesn't start when everything was going right and the lights were on and everything was great and all of the circumstances were perfect and Jesus comes into the world. Boom. The story of Ruth starts in a dark world of hopelessness and despair and loss and all of these questions of God, what are you going to do next? And the Christmas story, a Mary and Joseph, unmarried and pregnant, heading back to Bethlehem, the story starts, God enters the world in a story that starts with darkness and hopelessness and all of these questions of what's going to happen and God, what are you going to do next? See, it's my hope that if you're here and this Christmas season feels hard, it feels dark, it feels like you just wish you could kind of speed past it. Like Christmas is happening, but you're kind of, you feel like you're on the outside looking in. My hope is that in the story of Ruth, in the story of Jesus and Mary and Joseph, what you might find is that you're not on the outside of the story. But that this story welcomes you in wherever you are, whatever this season's like for you. That this story welcomes you in and it invites you that in the midst of the potential darkness, in the midst of the hopelessness, in the midst of despair, the Christmas story reminds us time and again, every year when we tell it, that it was in those moments that a light was lit. It was in those moments that God came into the world and maybe, just maybe it's in those moments in our lives that God might be doing something, that God might meet us like he did in those stories, maybe in some ways that we would least likely expect it. But the truth we get to hold on to is that the message of Christmas, Emmanuel, God with us, was true for them just as much as it is true for us today. Would you pray with me? God, for the story of Ruth, for the way it points forward to the story of your son, of you, Jesus, entering into the world, into a time that from the outside looked unlikely. When Rome sat on the throne, when there was one who claimed to be the king of the Jews, and God, who was in that moment, in the darkness, in the despair, in the hopelessness that the people had felt, that your light came into the world in your son, in you, Jesus. And so, God, we just pray that wherever we are in this moment, in this season, God, that you would meet us in those moments, that you would open our eyes to the way you are present, even in the midst of our stories today. And God, we pray that we might turn our attention, our direction, that we might give our lives to you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.